But there is the cool thing about mergers is that's actually where the stuff gets dinged. You know, otherwise it just sits there, you know, for the most part, and it's not doing anything. But in a neutron star merger, you've got two of these blobs of the densest stuff the universe contains smashing into each other. So that gives you an opportunity. If you watch how that behaves, you see the electromagnetic radiation that's given off, you see the gravitational waves that are given off. That gives you an opportunity to see how this stuff behaves when it's, you know, stirred dramatically. Like stirred is an understatement, right? It's really undergoes a major smush as these two things crash into each other. So it gives you an opportunity to measure all sorts of dynamical responses and properties and things like that. So that's one of the reasons people like studying neutron star mergers.
You're listening to Masterminds, where we sit down with experts in science and medicine to talk about everything from the research of today to the innovation of tomorrow. This is Will.
And this is Mishka. And today we sat down with Professor Mark Alford, theoretical physicist and former chair of the Department of Physics at Washington University. Professor Alford researches the physics of ultra-high density matter, such as in the core of a neutron star, to get insights on how particles behave in situations that we do not encounter on Earth.
He has also done important work on characterizing quantum chromodynamics, or QCD, which describes the strong interactions between quarks that make up larger particles like protons and neutrons. In this episode, we talk about some of the basics of quantum mechanics and how they are applied in studying astrophysical phenomena.
We also touch on some important philosophical questions regarding how to use physics in understanding the nature of reality. We think the episode boils down many complex topics in physics so that anyone with a basic level of understanding will learn a lot. We hope you enjoy this episode. So we usually start off with just a little bit of background with our guests. What in your childhood do you feel like led you to a career in science and physics specifically?
I think really I was just kind of born that way, as they say. I didn't have some special teacher or some special person who drew me into it. I think I was just always drawn into science-y type things. I had various changes. You know, I thought I was interested in chemistry for a while. I was interested in chemistry. I had a chemistry set back when chemistry sets could contain quite interesting and exciting ingredients in useful quantities, and did all sorts of things with that. And then I discovered that particle physics was sort of like chemistry in the sense of building things out of subconstituents and understanding how they behaved. And then I moved into particle physics, and then there's been some sort of further diffusion since then.
And after your undergraduate education at Oxford, you came to the US to study here at Harvard. What made you come here, and are there any differences in the physics communities in Britain and the US?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so I came to the US because my perception at the time was, you know, the US is top country. You know, it's the big pool with the big fish, and I wanted to, you know, be in that pool with those fish. So, and it was not so easy then. There was no internet, right? You had to actually write a letter and ask for application materials to be mailed back to you, and you had to read brochures and things. It was quite a different process. And it was the first time I'd ever been on a plane when I took the plane to come to grad school in the US. That was why I did that. And the difference is, well, I did go back to the UK briefly as a faculty member, and there are certainly differences in the way universities operate. But I think physicists, maybe academics in general, tend to form this kind of layer across countries. The truth is, I think a physics professor, or maybe even just a science academic in the US, may have more in common with a fellow science academic in England or France or even Japan than they do with somebody in their own town that where their university is, who has a totally different life, who drives a bus, maybe. You know, I think the scientists form this, their kind of own layer.
And then what eventually brought you to WashU?
Well, yes, I was offered a nice job here is the answer to that. I had visited for a conference once, and I liked the place, and when they offered me a faculty job here, I was very pleased and accepted.
So now on to some of your research and teaching. As a theoretical physicist, you study quantum mechanics primarily. To start off, can you describe the basics of what is quantum physics and how it's different from classical physics?
Okay, so I use quantum physics in everything I do. I wouldn't say that, so, but no more or less than anyone else who's doing the stuff that I do, which is kind of at the interface of particle physics, nuclear physics, astrophysics. We all have to use quantum mechanics. And so, yeah, the thing with quantum mechanics is that you use different, very different mathematical tools. In classical physics, you tend to think in terms of particles with positions and speeds, and they move around and they feel forces and they arrange themselves in certain ways. And you can think of gases that way, and you can think of solids that way, and it all seems okay. But if you try and actually get quantitative answers out, you find that the classical treatment, where you think of them that way, just doesn't work. And you have to use a quantum mechanical treatment, where the way you think about a particle is totally different. There's this function, a wave function, that tells you stuff about where the particle is and where it's going, but not in the straightforward intuitive way that when you think in terms of a position and a speed, that's just obvious, right? You think about things that way normally anyway, as a human being. Quantum mechanics makes you think about it in a totally different way, with things like wave functions that obey rules that don't seem intuitive at all. And you really have to follow the math and grind through it and see what answer it spits out.
And next, I think I'd like to get into some of your at least earlier research with Frank Wilczek, who's one of my personal favorite scientific communicators. And you've done a lot of work with him on QCD, which is what he recently won the Nobel Prize in Physics for. Can you start by explaining what quarks are and how QCD describes their interactions?
Okay, yes. So, yes, and I think you're right to have Frank Wilczek as one of your favorite scientists for any number of reasons. So quarks are what's inside protons and neutrons, and protons and neutrons are what's inside the nuclei that are in the middle of the atoms that make up us. So they're subconstituents of matter, somewhat buried down in the hierarchy. You look in an atom, you see electrons. You look in the nucleus, you see neutrons and protons. Finally, you look in the neutrons and protons, you see quarks. And so that's what they are. They're these little particles that run around in there and are very strongly interacting. There's this very strong attraction between quarks that's described by this theory called quantum chromodynamics, QCD. And it's interesting because the interaction is so strong that you can't pull a quark out and get it on its own. Normally, when you think of something being made up of things, you can imagine the constituents all far apart from each other to start with, and then you bring them together and you make the thing, like you build a house, or you assemble a watch or something like that. You put it together out of the pieces, like Lego. In this case, these Lego blocks can't really be pulled apart from each other, so you can never get them on their own. And that actually raises a kind of question insofar, can you really talk about something as being a thing in its own right, if it can only come as part of a package with another thing? But you can do experiments on these things, like whack them rather hard with a photon, that show that as at very high momenta, when they move very fast, then they are kind of independent. So when they're moving slowly, they're all tied together to other quarks by the strong interaction, which is described by QCD. But QCD also says that if you just sort of wiggle them back and forth very fast, then they kind of behave like they're on their own. So you can see some sort of it's a particle behavior with quarks. You just can't see all the aspects of it's a particle behavior that you might have expected.
And in quantum chromodynamics, the chromo part, what do physicists mean when they talk about different colors of quarks?
Yeah, that's a label for some sort of property that the quarks have that makes them experience this force. So by analogy with electromagnetic forces, you're used to things like static electricity or something. You know, you take a piece of clothing off and you get this charge on the clothing and this charge left on you, and sparks fly back and forth. And that's to do with the plus and the minus charges of electromagnetism. So if you asked what is charge, it would be hard to say. It's just this thing that is the source of electric fields and magnetic fields and is there in nature, and that we see its effects when we see anything electromagnetic, you know, from lightning to electric currents and magnetic fields. It's all to do with these charges, plus and minus charges moving. So the strong interaction is just some other property. It couples to some other property, just like an electric field is created and sourced by electric charge. So things with charge sort of emit an electric field. Things with this, quote, color, it's just a name, emit this other kind of field that is responsible for this other kind of interaction, which is the strong interaction that binds the quarks together to make the neutrons and protons. So it's kind of just a name for something that they chose, this name that happens to also be a word in English, which is sometimes great and sometimes horrible. You know, it's great in that you can sort of imagine it, and it's very helpful making slides. You know, oh, I've got red and green and blue, and that, you know, these things have color. But it can be confusing. It's actually very common in physics: energy, force, you know, potential. These are all things that we kind of kidnap these words and give them technical meanings, and we use them in that technical sense. But somebody listening to the sentence and using ordinary English definitions in their head, it all sounds a bit weird.
And what is unique about the strong force as described by QCD compared to the weak force, the electromagnetic force, some of the concepts of that I've heard talked about, like asymptotic freedom that we'll check.
Okay. So asymptotic freedom was what I was just kind of alluding to when I said that if you wiggle the quarks very fast, then they behave more like they're free. And if you move them slowly, then you find you can't get them away from their neighbors, and the interaction behaves as if it's super strong. So asymptotic freedom is this funny dependence on how fast you wiggle them, that where the interaction gets weaker when you wiggle things very fast, and it gets stronger when you move them back and forth slowly. That's asymptotic freedom. And that's a striking property of the strong interaction. That's one of the most noticeable properties it has.
And I've also heard it been compared to how other forces can be like magnets that get stuck together. The stronger the force is, the closer they are, whereas the strong force is like a rubber band, where the farther it gets, the stronger the force is.
Well, actually, it's not that the further away, the stronger. It's just that it doesn't drop off with distance. Mm. It's like a rubber band, in the sense that if you're pulling on a rubber band, then for a while, or a spring, for a while, up until you sort of hit the limit where it doesn't want to go anymore, you actually don't know how extended it is. It pulls with the same force. It depends on the kind of material. But it's that sort of thing. It's where it doesn't drop off with distance.
And what are some of the other important fundamental particles, like gluons, and how do they interact with quarks?
Yeah, so gluons are even more hard to sort of pin down. They behave not like particles in the normal sense either, because they carry the strong force, if you like. They are the mediators of the strong force, like photons are the mediators of the electromagnetic force. But the gluons themselves are charged under the strong force. They have color, as we say. And so you've got this kind of self-creating system where the particles that are just transmitting the force also create more of themselves. It's as if the photon was electrically charged. And so the whole thing gets very complicated and nonlinear and out of control. And it's very difficult to analyze. So electromagnetism is something that I'm teaching it right now, you know, physics two, you know, the second semester of introductory physics is all about electromagnetism, and people with very little previous knowledge of physics other than physics one from the previous semester can take that course and learn quite a bit about electromagnetism. This other force, the strong force, you can't do that. We don't know. You know, people use computers, gigantic computers, to grind away at million dimensional integrals to try and brute force their way through the complexities of the strong interaction and predict the most basic things about it, about its behavior. It's really very intractable.
So when studying these concepts that aren't really capable of being grasped by the human mind, because of, like you were talking about, the way we experience the world is very different. When you're studying it, how do you go through the mental gymnastics of trying to understand this stuff? Or do you understand it purely on a mathematical basis?
I think it's a mixture of both. So with a lot of things in physics, there's math and there's a kind of intuition. And sometimes you get the intuition for free. Like if you're talking about particles bouncing around in you know, like you think a classical picture of a gas, particles bouncing around in a box, then just your built-in intuition with no training already gives you an idea of how that should behave. And you have a sense that if they're bouncing around, then they're sort of rattling, hitting the side of the box, and there should be something like pressure if you average it up over many collisions. And that's sort of, you can feel that already in your gut without any special training. So what happens when you're doing these other things like quantum mechanics or you know, the strong interaction QCD, is you have to do quite a lot of the mathematical calculations where you just track through the math and kind of just take it that it's the math's going to give you the right answer. And then if you do that enough times, you start to develop some intuition for how those things work. And you end up training a sort of new branch of your intuition that gradually grows and becomes able to give you intuitive answers to questions without doing the mathematical calculation. And I it may be a little bit analogous to things like learning to drive, you know, where you start off having to do it very painfully and consciously and keeping track of every movement you make. But at some point, it becomes a bit more automatic and you just kind of know how to do it. So a lot of things that we learn, you know, I think work that way.
And another area of your research that you've been involved in more recently is on neutron stars, which I find very fascinating. Can you start by explaining the basics? What are neutron stars and why are there mergers of interest to theoretical physicists like yourself?
Okay, so neutron stars are sort of what's left over when big stars explode. So there's stars all over the place in our galaxy, in other galaxies in the cosmos. Some of these stars are much heavier than our sun, like 30, 40 times heavier. If they're heavy like that, then as they go through their life, using up their nuclear fuel by doing fusion, at the end of their life, they'll explode. And that's called a supernova. They'll be very bright for a few seconds. And then they collapse and leave behind this lump called a neutron star. So there's neutron stars all over the place where these stars have exploded and left them behind. So they're of interest to astrophysicists for that reason, but they're of interest to particle and nuclear physicists like me, because that's the densest state of matter you can have in the universe. It's where a whole star like the sun has collapsed to be the size of St. Louis. Right? So that's a gigantic amount of matter crammed into a very modest volume. So these densities are insane. They're like trillions of times the density of anything we have on Earth. They are the most extreme high density form of matter that the universe contains. And so we're interested in understanding that, you know.
And how do neutron stars undergo mergers?
So yeah, sometimes Many stars occur in binaries, right? Stars are sometimes on their own, like our sun, but many stars have a companion. They just go round and round each other. And if they're both heavy, then over time, one of them will go supernova and leave behind a neutron star. And then later, the other one will go supernova and leave behind a neutron star. And then you've got two neutron stars going around each other. And as they go around each other, they gradually spiral in, and eventually they just collapse on to be in the same place. And that's a merger. That's another very violent collision.
And how do neutron stars affect the space around them?
Okay, so they curve the space around them. That's just Einstein's general theory of relativity. So they have an enormously strong gravitational fields. I should say another interesting thing about both supernovas and neutron star mergers is that a lot of the stuff that we have on Earth came from those things. The Earth is full of stuff, silicon and iron and cobalt and nickel and all this stuff. And yet when you ask about what the universe started with, it was hydrogen and helium pretty much. So how come there's all this other stuff around the place to make a rocky planet like Earth, you know, so we can then dig it up and make it into jewelry and whatever? And all those heavier elements are created in stars, and the heavy ones are created maybe somewhat in supernovas, but we think, although this is not completely certain, that quite a bit of them get made in these neutron star mergers. So if, you know, gold and uranium, elements like that, are very likely, well, you know, the current theory has some weight behind it, that they're made in neutron star mergers.
And I'm not sure how far away the closest neutron star is, but I assume that most of them are far away. How do you go about studying them?
Yeah, I think the closest one's a few hundred light years away. Most of them are scattered across the galaxy, which would put them thousands and tens of thousands of light years away. So yeah, it's okay. Yeah. So I, as a nuclear/particle theorist, am interested in them because they're this super compressed state of matter, way beyond anything we can do with a piston or a press in a terrestrial lab. But as you say, they're not very convenient for studying the densest state of matter because they're so far away. So then you go to your astronomer colleagues and you ask them to tell you what they see through their telescopes. And there's various things you see through telescopes. You can detect X-rays from neutron stars. You can detect radio waves from neutron stars. We've recently detected gravitational waves from merging neutron stars. So there's a certain amount of information. It's not like being a condensed matter experimentalist with a lab at WashU who can take a chunk of, you know, graphite or something and stick electrodes on it and squeeze it and heat it and do what they like and measure what happens and come up with all sorts of material properties. We're stuck with this very inconvenient lab that's thousands of light years away, and we can't make it do anything. We just have to look at what it chooses to do. But there is the cool thing about mergers is that's actually where the stuff gets dinged. You know, otherwise it just sits there, you know, for the most part, and it's not doing anything. But in a neutron star merger, you've got two of these blobs of the densest stuff the universe contains smashing into each other. So that gives you an opportunity. If you watch how that behaves, you see the electromagnetic radiation that's given off, you see the gravitational waves that are given off. That gives you an opportunity to see how this stuff behaves when it's, you know, stirred dramatically. Like, stirred is an understatement, right? It's really undergoes a major smush as these two things crash into each other. So it gives you an opportunity to measure all sorts of dynamical responses and properties and things like that. So that's one of the reasons people like studying neutron star mergers.
And one of the most common things that I see you publish about in relation to these ultra dense states of matter is superconductivity. Can you talk about what superconductivity is and how it's portrayed in neutron stars?
Okay, you're covering highlights of modern physics here, but this is great. So superconductivity is a phenomenon that we do see on Earth. You know, there's plenty of superconductors, and It's a very interesting condensed matter physics phenomenon, which when we see it on Earth, we see some metal, we cool it down very, very cold, and normally it has some electrical resistance. You have to put a voltage across it to get a current to flow through it. But below some very low temperature, suddenly the electrical resistance drops to zero, and it's what we call a superconductor. So you can see that in a metal here on Earth. And what you're seeing is a behavior of the electrons, that a metal is basically a box of electrons. And so the electrons are zipping around pretty free, and they sort of relax into this very specially correlated state where you can get a current going in it without having to force it with a voltage. So that's a superconductor on Earth. Now, neutron stars are made of, they have electrons in them, but they have other particles in them, neutrons and protons. And the neutrons and protons have quarks in them. And it turns out that the ability to form this kind of state where in the case of the terrestrial superconductor, the electrons, they form these pairs and make this state that carries a current very, very easily. This phenomenon is generic to that type of particle. So protons will do it, neutrons will do it, quarks will do it. So there's a sort of interesting echo in neutron star material of what happens on Earth. On Earth, you do it with metals, and you're seeing electrons form Cooper pairs and make a superconductor. And in a neutron star, you can see neutrons do that. And you may see protons do that. And you may, if speculatively, if they're compressed enough to make some kind of quark matter, you could see quarks do that. So it's funny. This stuff is totally unlike anything on Earth, but the concepts of condensed matter physics still apply. You can still talk about electrical conductivity and viscosity and how much it resists compression, compressibility, and all these things. It's still a material. It's just a material that's crazily different, with different values for these properties. But the kind of properties that it can have are still those kind of things.
How are some of those other properties replicated in materials that we can make on Earth?
There's also superfluidity, which is related to superconductivity, and people have a general belief based on observations of things called glitches that neutron star material is superfluid, at least at some range of densities, that it's a superfluid. And we make superfluids on Earth. Liquid helium will behave like a is a superfluid if it's cold enough, it's liquid helium. So, you can see basically the same phenomena. The energy scale is very different, but the essential phenomena can be very similar.
And earlier you mentioned quark matter. Could you explain what that is and how quark matter stars are different from nucleon stars?
Well, so nobody knows if there are quark matter stars. But the basic idea is, so you imagine ordinary material on Earth, it comes in all different types. There's different compounds, calcium carbonate and things like that. And then there's things like wood, which goodness knows what it is. There's no chemical formula for that. You can so there's all different there's a great diversity of different kinds of material. If you compress them, however, the amount of diversity begins to go down. And this is what happens in that supernova when the star explodes. Remember, I was talking about where these neutron stars come from. Heavy star explodes, and the core collapses under its own gravity because it's not shining anymore. It's not developing any heat to sort of support it against its own gravity. So it undergoes this dramatic gravitational collapse, and it gets crushed by factors of like almost a million in size. And that means that the atoms themselves are actually crushed. So instead of having multiple arrangements of atoms that can give you all sorts of interesting materials, you go down to the atoms all being crushed down into their component parts. So the electrons around the outside of the atom get kind of ground into the nucleus, and the atoms themselves collapse. And you end up with this sort of slurry of neutrons, protons, and electrons. So that's what a neutron star is. It's where all the structure has been ground down to nothing, and you just have the basic material, you know, a sort of liquid of neutrons, protons, and electrons. Quarks would be what you get if you continued that process and said, okay, we got rid of the structure of atoms and just crushed it down into a liquid of neutrons and protons and electrons with no spatial arrangement to them. They're just all smushed together. Now, what if we did the same thing with those neutrons and protons? You know, each one of them has three little quarks in it. What if we smush the neutrons and protons together? Eventually, the arrangement of the quarks, them being spatially arranged into neutrons and protons, would also be crushed out of existence. And you just have a sort of liquid of quarks. And that's quark matter. It's this hypothetical state that you'd get if you could crush matter to high enough density beyond a neutron star. Because in a neutron star, there's this one little bit of structure surviving. It's all just neutrons and protons everywhere, but within each neutron and within each proton, there are three quarks. And the idea is if you keep ratcheting up the pressure, eventually you'll crush those little blobs out of existence, and you'll just have basically quarks and electrons. And that's quark matter.
So when you go about studying these theoretical quark matter stars, do you have to simulate them in computers? And just in general, what is the process of studying something like that that we don't know exists?
Well, so actually, even for the neutron stars, where it's neutrons, protons, and electrons, a big blob the size of St. Louis, consisting of a liquid of neutrons, protons, and electrons, even there, we don't have a very good grasp of the interactions between the neutrons and the protons and the electrons. We have some idea, but even there, you're having to use theories that work in some limits or approximate models and then do computer simulations using those. This is to do with the fact that that strong interaction, QCD, is so intractable that we don't have a nice, clean, easily used theory of the strong interaction between the neutrons and protons. So already at that point, we're using models and doing a certain amount of computer calculation, obviously, because it's a big and complicated system. So when you're doing it with quarks, it's just more of the same. Really, you just have to come up with some sort of reasonable model for the quark-quark interaction. The true quark-quark interaction, QCD, is very hard to deal with. And at high densities, it becomes even harder to deal with. So people can't do what they'd like to do. It's a very funny situation. You can write down the mathematical description, which we think is correct. It's the current theory, been confirmed by a lot of experiments. But you can write down that theory in a fairly compact way, but you can't calculate its consequences. It would require you to do these unbelievably heroic things, like I mentioned before, multi-million dimensional integrals and things like that, that are just, you know, even the biggest computers have a hard time doing them. So we're stuck with that sort of challenge in trying to understand quark matter. And so we end up compromising and using much rougher models, which is actually kind of what condensed matter people on Earth sometimes end up doing as well. For complicated electronic systems, it can sometimes be difficult to work out how they're going to behave as well.
And what has your research discovered regarding hybrid stars composed of both quark matter and nucleons?
Okay, so hybrid stars are also speculative. Right, we don't know what's in the middle of a neutron star. Right, we can see radiation coming from the surface, but we don't know how dense it is in the middle. A hybrid star would be where you've got quark matter in the middle and nuclear matter around the outside. It's possible there's quark matter in the middle of neutron stars, but we don't know. So I and many other people have worked on the possibility of hybrid stars, and we found some interesting things. Mostly, though, it's the The results depend on what you assume about the quark matter. And because we have such a hard time theoretically predicting the properties of quark matter, you tend to end up with a bunch of parameterizations where you say, well, if it behaves like this, then you'd see that. And if it behaves like this, then you'd see that. So it's not like there are definite predictions for the most part of how quark matter is going to behave. It's more like finding options, possible behaviors. So one of the things that I worked on was forms of superconductivity and superfluidity in quark matter, which was useful because up to that point, people had assumed that quark matter had one basic form, that it was like free quarks pretty much. And what we explored and showed could matter quite a bit was that if you had a superconducting form of quark matter or a superfluid form of quark matter, and there are very good reasons based on QCD to think that it might well like to do that, then it would behave very differently. And so your criteria for saying, oh, we've detected it, or your criteria for saying, oh, we've ruled it out, you have to be careful and take into account all the different possible forms quark matter could take.
And next, I'd like to move on to this 2006 paper that you sent me that was, again, very fascinating, authored by you and two other physicists regarding Roger Penrose's triangle. Can you first explain what is the matter-mind triangle and what it aims to explain?
Right. So the math-matter-mind triangle, which you can easily find out about if you Google math-matter-mind triangle, I think you may get our paper before you get Roger Penrose's original account of it. I'm not sure. But yeah, he wrote down this triangle where he had these three things that happened to begin with M. So that's delightful. Math, matter, and mind. And you arrange them in a triangle. And then you have these three arrows which say, well, matter gives rise to the mind. So there's an arrow from matter to mind. And the mind gives rise to math. So there's an arrow from mind to math. And then Roger Penrose is interested in ideas about how math underlies reality. And certainly math gives us very good physics theories to describe matter. And so you have an arrow from math to matter, somehow representing how the laws of physics use math to describe matter. So you've got these three arrows going in a circle, you know, matter to mind, mind to math, math to matter.
And in the paper, you and the other authors describe these three views, the fundamentalist, secular, and mystic views on this concept. And I found it very interesting because I think it well demonstrates that there can be diversity of thought within the scientific community. And I'd love for you to explain some of the basics of these views in their relation to Penrose's triangle, and which, if any, you found most convincing.
Well, so those three views corresponded one-on-one with the three authors, right? So one of us was the fundamentalist, one of us was the mystic, and one of us, me, was the secularist. And it was interesting how we realized that our different views of this triangle match rather well to these religious orientations, you know, that within religions you have, or, you know, within religious thought, you have people who are mystics, people who are fundamentalists and very dedicated to one set of doctrines, and secularists who are not really that strongly attached to any set of doctrines. And so it turned out that our different views of that triangle and the different ways in which we disagreed with it or would want to change it, interestingly mapped onto those three religious orientations. So Max Tegmark was the fundamentalist, and he wanted to just get rid of one of the links. And he just wanted to say that math is at the bottom of everything. He just wanted to have math goes to matter, matter goes to mind, and that's the end of it. Okay, so he has this very fundamentalist, very radical idea that the universe actually is math, and so matter is just a sort of form of math, kind of, I don't know, somehow distilled out, and that minds come from matter, and So there's just two arrows. Pete Hart, as the mystic, had a more sort of transcendental view where he wanted to say that it's not like there's three arrows going round in a triangle from one thing to the other. I think his was more of a Mercedes-Benz, where they all come from some deeper underlying thing, the nature of which is not apparent to us, but they are all different aspects of this other thing that we are sort of reaching for. And I was the secularist, and so I had sort of mind and matter as two aspects of reality, and math as this thing that comes from minds. So mine was another modification of that triangle.
So can you expand upon your secular view? Do you view mathematics as purely a tool almost invented by humans to understand the universe?
Well, I don't know if I want to say purely a tool. So that paper is quite contentious. We sort of squabble and argue in it because we each get sections where we state our opinion, and then there's another section where somebody else says what they think is wrong, and then the other person gets to reply. I hope that makes it readable in the sense that there's this kind of argument going on between different viewpoints, and each one is working hard to make the reader, to persuade the reader. So when in my view of math, as expressed in that paper, I was really reacting to the fundamentalist idea that the universe is math, that math is this sort of thing that you could actually say that the universe is a mathematical, not just described by math, but it is actually, I don't know how to say it any better, it is math. And that seemed to me to be sort of really, very radical, should we say. And I didn't think it was right at all. And I think that math is a human construction, obviously. It also has this kind of unavoidable quality. Like you find a mathematical truth and it just seems like, of course it's that way. It has to be that way. It's unavoidably that way. It's something I've discovered. And anybody else who explored along the same avenues would necessarily discover the exact same truths that I've uncovered in doing my math. And that's true. You know, you do feel that way. It's not like math is the only thing that works that way, though. You know, there are other things that work that way. Like, you know, is this a correct sentence of English? You know, that's, you know, you instantly know something's not grammatically correct. Moral truths as well. Of course, you know, famously, morality is held up as subjective, but I think there are quite a lot of moral principles that are quite hard to imagine disagreeing with. So I think that there's, just because it's got that hardness about it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a human construct. But more importantly, it was this idea that, what do you mean by math? You know, what's included in math? Because it's a human activity, and what counts as valid mathematical activity has changed over time. Like computer proofs, right? Is a proof done by a computer, is that a proof? That's a decision that mathematicians have to make as to whether they extend their boundary to include those things. And what is future math going to look like? We know that in the past, math changed. Like, you know, there was a time when math was pretty much the natural numbers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. And, you know, there are innovations. Zero is an innovation. Negative numbers are an innovation. Irrational numbers caused an awful lot of fuss. Hard to believe that there's such a thing as an irrational number. Really? You can't express it as a ratio of integers? Seriously? And so, you know, new ingredients get added in, and we don't know. I think we have to be a bit sort of humble and say, what is called math 100 years from now or 500 years from now might look unrecognizable to us. In fact, we might object to it violently and say, that's not math. And the same is true with physics. There's this indeterminacy in quantum mechanics. I'm pretty sure that a lot of 19th century physicists, if they saw what we do with quantum mechanics, would be horrified, at that being called a fundamental theory. It's indeterminate. It doesn't predict. It's got some vague probabilities in it. Well, you've only done half the work, right? So these things can change. And so to say the world is made of math, I mean, math is a bunch of stuff that mathematicians do now, but who knows what it is going to be in the future? Who knows what will be included in that under that umbrella? So it just seemed to me that it was, well, I think Pete Hutt called it a category mistake, drawing on Gilbert Ryle from, philosophers of the past. It just seemed very, very hard to take seriously. But I have to say, Max has gone on to write more and more papers about this, and is very much enjoys advocating that idea.
So this discussion, I think, points at another interesting point that I found repeated in each of your discussions in that paper, which is the capability of physics and our ability to study it and how that describes the universe. Like, are we theoretically sometime in the future, are we capable of completely understanding the physics of the universe? Or are we sort of in Plato's cave where we're just explaining the shadows and we're incapable of seeing what's actually behind us? What is the secularist view on that?
Yeah, so it is interesting that doing science is one thing, and having a sort of vision of what it means is another. And everyone doing these calculations in physics and doing experiments in chemistry and biology and theorizing in chemistry and biology, they're all doing things that are compatible. They can all go to the conferences and talk to each other. But once, and that was like the three of us would be like that in this paper. But when you start asking, what do you think is the significance, the meaning of it, you can have very different ideas. And yeah, so what I find strange is when people think that they have, or that they could reasonably expect to have in the future, an unimprovable understanding, right? Some sort of dreams of a final theory. They want something final, like, this is the answer, no more improvements beyond that. So I have no idea whether that's possible. Okay. It doesn't seem practically possible, because whatever theory you have, there are always going to be experiments. We haven't dialed up the energy to the highest possible values yet. There's some highest energy we've explored. There's some smallest size we've explored. There's a whole bunch of experimental parameters that we have only tweaked within some range. We only measure things to a certain accuracy. So there could always be other things beyond, that we haven't discovered yet. And it seems to me to be a bit of a pointless vision to say, I want a final, unimprovable theory. What I think the secularist view is, I want a good theory, right? One that works, one that helps me make predictions and see what's going to happen. And yes, understand, but understand in a sense that I have a picture that makes sense and allows me to get an intuitive sense of what's going on. But the idea that the terms in which that picture works are the terms and can never be updated just seems ludicrous to me. It's ahistorical. You see the changes that have happened from electromagnetism in the 19th century, and then you have special relativity and quantum mechanics, and everything totally changes. And instead of talking about charged particles, we're talking about wave functions. And so you can have changes that seem small in some ways. You have to measure to quite a few digits to see this effect, but the underlying theory changes dramatically, and the fundamental entities change dramatically. So your concept of space-time changes dramatically with special relativity. So I don't see why that, it doesn't seem to be converging, right? Why should you think that every revolution that comes is gradually going to settle down on one? I don't know. But it's taste at the end of the day. So I don't see why you'd expect that, but if you find that a very satisfying thing that drives you to do good science, then okay.
Do you have a favorite unsolved problem in physics?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't think I have a favorite one. There are some very interesting ones out there. Like the one that everyone always talks about is unifying quantum mechanics with gravity. That's the big sort of unmet promise of physics. There are other ones like understanding turbulence, which is outside my area of expertise completely, but how fluids go from flowing in a nice smooth way to lots of little crazy vortices. There's other interesting problems like that. There's just yeah how does how and closer to my own backyard, there's this question of just how does matter behave when you just keep squeezing it and squeezing it and squeezing it and squeezing it and get to the highest densities that nature can offer. Like, what does it behave like? Is it a superconductor? Is it a superfluid? Is it an insulator? Is it transparent? What does it do? That's to me, that's my sort of personal interesting question.
And who are the physicists that you look up to in your career?
Oh, that's also an interesting question. So, I so yeah. So Frank Wilczek is a great physicist who I had a lot of contact with early in my career. We worked on a lot of things together, and I don't want to, just single one person out and say that they're better than the rest. But I think Frank exemplifies a lot of the better aspects of what scientists can be like, because scientists can be arrogant, sort of know-it-all, things like that. They can be stubborn and unwilling to listen to new ideas. And Frank is I think all has all the good aspects packaged up. He's an easy to get on with person. He's extremely smart and extremely creative and thinks, comes up with new ideas, wild ideas, but also understands the physics itself very well and behaves in a decent sort of way, behaves well to people who have much less power than him. I think there are a lot of ways in which science is better the more Frank Wilczeks there are in it.
And lastly, do you have any advice for young scientists and college students going forward in their careers?
So there's all sorts of obvious pieces of advice that people give, like, oh, if you follow your enthusiasm and stuff like that, big picture things. So one small very I to go to the opposite extreme, how about every day do something that moves you towards your goals and something that makes you happy now? Okay, so instead of big career advice, it's just survive day-to-day advice.
I like it. That's kind of what I'm embracing as a second semester senior here at the moment. So, very fitting.
Yes, thank you, Professor Alfred. This was such a treat. I think our audience will love this discussion.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Professor Alfred was such a treat to talk to about all these complex topics in theoretical physics.
His passion for education comes through in the ways he can talk about fundamental questions in physics, and this discussion makes Will and I consider how we view the philosophy of science.
This episode also makes us look out into the cosmos in a different way. Knowing that such violent events are occurring out there without us knowing is fascinating.
If you like the Masterminds podcast, you can support us by following us on Spotify or subscribing on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Masterminds Pod. Please leave comments on any of our latest posts if there are any topics or guests you would like to include on future episodes. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Masterminds.